beautiful Wednesday. Nice day to be driving home, listening to the radio, perhaps. You might be doing. If you're tuned in, I'm glad you are. It's time for American Hit Radio. WHPC 90.3 FM is the radio station. I'm your host, Tom Ryan, my lovely wife, co-host, Heidi Morales Ryan, here as well.
That's right.
Now, Wednesdays, we've been doing a variety of countdowns, moving like last year from one, this year, the compliment. Soon they'll be joining up, and we'll be doing them all together. We started by doing the alternative top 40, which was a list of albums that never made the top 40. We have 500 of them that we intended to cover starting in 1964. Then realized that it makes a lot more sense to cover them in conjunction with those that did make the top 40. So we went back to 1964 again, and this time dropped in our favorite albums that did make the top 40.
And now it makes so much more sense.
Well, you get this great crosstalk, and especially when we get to the point where we stopped with the other, and then we start moving along in conjunction with one another. We just move month by month by month through time. Right now, since we are focusing on the albums that did make the top 40, we're up to album number 26 in that regard. And that takes us to the month of April of 1966. Last album that we did was in December of 1965. We had three entries from then. So we suddenly jump all the way to April 1966 with our next classic entry, which happens to be a Rolling Stones album. Now, this could seem redundant. In some ways it is, because three of the past six albums that we chose as the greatest, the top 500 of the top 40, the best albums, 50% of them out of the past six have been Rolling Stone albums.
And the rest of them were Beatles.
Well, there was a Beatles album and a Stones album and a Dylan album in there as well. Or a Beach Boys album. It's hard to remember even at this point.
So confusing.
But number 21 was a Stones album. That was Out of Our Heads. Number 24 was another Stones album. That was in December. That was December's Children, thus the name. And those two albums in so many ways are interchangeable, one with another. They both have a massive hit, Satisfaction on one, Get Off of My Cloud on the other, a bunch of really good original songs to complement that hit, and some great covers, and plus a smattering of live recordings that they took off of a really good live EP. So there's so much that those albums have in common that it's almost hard to tell them apart. You certainly can't pick one without picking the other, because
right. They're
so alike. This album is distinctly different. Coming out in April 1966, the album is called Aftermath, and it's a big deal because this is the very first Rolling Stones album where every song is written by Mick Jagger and Keith Richards. Sort of a sea change for the band. Up until this point, we've been chronicling their releases here in America, album by album by album, because they virtually have all of the albums of original, well, I should say original material, but albums that was recorded specifically for an LP release. We've pretty much included everything that was released in America because they're all great. The Stones albums, it's a great catalog. But you can hear them growing by leaps and bounds. And 1966, each year could be viewed in a very specific way. 1964 was definitely the year that rock and roll experienced a rebirth. Rock and roll was on the decline from 1960 because of all the scandals, because of the deaths that were taking place, because Elvis was in the army, and the backlash. Rock and roll began to more or less disappear. By 1963, 1964, the charts consisted significantly of things like girl groups and R&B music, and pop music, very little rock and roll per se. Obviously, that changed in 1964 with the British invasion. The Beatles started this. The Stones followed suit very quickly. The Rolling Stones, I'm sorry, here in America, the Beach Boys took up the challenge and started making better and better albums, more sophisticated albums. And then Bob Dylan started to make waves as though he was moving toward rock and roll by releasing a few singles that had electrical instrumentation on it and talking about the Beatles and admiring them. 1965, you could see how rock and roll was beginning to become somewhat stylized. You saw people moving toward one another that year. The different styles were beginning to coalesce. You could see, like, the Beatles on Rubber Soul using some folk influences. Of course, the Rolling Stones starting to write because they were challenged by the Beatles. An obvious one, Dylan Goes Electric. And, of course, Brian Wilson being challenged very much so by the Beatles. 1966, though, is the year that it all begins to come together. Perhaps it's the most important year, as each of these acts begin to develop a unique identity until their own style of music is virtually perfected. Each of the big four, shall we say, release banner albums in 1966. Perhaps albums that you could say literally define their careers. Aftermath could be considered that for the Stones. The Beach Boys had Pet Sounds. Dylan had Blonde on Blonde, 1966. And the Beatles had Revolver, all in the same year. So it's not like the big four that we've been following really closely all this time are going anywhere yet.
Right.
In fact, we started loving them in 1964 for a reason. This is the year where they all start to peak on their own, and they do start to influence other acts as well. It's also interesting to note, if you're a numbers nut like I am, this is album number 26, and we're at April of 1966 on top 40 albums. In the exact same count chronologically, albums that didn't make the top 40 at this point in time in April of 1966, in the same month of April, we covered the album Them Again by Them, Van Morrison and Them. That was album number 15. So we have almost twice as many great albums that did make the top 40 versus those that didn't. The reason? Fairly simple. There wasn't a million albums coming out every week that we were that we had access to. Every album, of course, was trying to make the top 40. You had a bit of a better chance of it back in 64 and 65 or 66 if you had a label deal.
Right.
So it's not that unusual that we would have twice as many albums on the top 40 at this point than those that did not make the top 40. So it's taking a little longer to count through the hit albums, per se, than it did take us to get to the same amount of time in the non-hit albums. Well, let's get right into it, because I want to cover every song on this album. There's two versions of Aftermath. Just like the Beatles, American albums versus British albums, they're usually very different. As a general rule, I've mentioned this before, the American albums, regarding the Rolling Stones, the American albums are usually the superior release. They're just generally better. That is so absolutely not the case with the Beatles. But in the Rolling Stones, it's odd because the label seemed to take the opportunity to assemble more hit-intensive albums. So, for example, the American version of Aftermath consists of 12 songs.
You think it had to do more with the way the executive... They weren't on the same label, obviously.
No, exactly, so. Yeah. So there were different choices being made. The label... For the American label for the Rolling Stones, coincidentally, was London Records. And they made choices that seemed to be rather intelligent as far as what to do. The British version of Aftermath had 14 songs. The American version only had 12. So right there you could say, yeah, but doesn't that give the British version an advantage? Well, it would, except for the fact that some of the songs that they knocked off didn't really make the album a better album. Songs like Take It or Leave It and What to Do were pushed aside and later used on an album of Leftovers that came out here in America called Flowers. Not a great album, not a bad album.
It was okay.
But those songs sort of deserved that. Well, by knocking off the songs that weren't particularly great, it gave the American album a chance to add a hit, which was essentially the leadoff track, the song that the Rolling Stones had just released as their new single, and also the leadoff track for Aftermath. It became a number one hit here in America, released just about the exact same time as the album. The name of that song was Painted Black.
Anymore, I want them. never to come back. I could not foresee this thing happening to you.
Great single. Odd choice, though, in a lot of ways, because obviously a song about a dead girlfriend.
Yeah.
That goes to a number
odd.
One. Yeah. You know, it's just weird. But I don't think America thought of it that way.
Right. They just got into the groove.
Yeah. It was basically a groove painted black with a comma also. That was another thing that threw everybody off. Painted black. That's the way that it read, you know, like what? Doesn't make any sense.
They just did that to throw people off even further, I'm sure.
Probably. But it worked. I mean, I don't think anybody really thought about the word for decades, about the words of the song for a very long
people
time.
Don't think about many of the words unless they can, like, mess it up and get the wrong message.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of analysis. But, I mean, it in a way, it makes some sense for basically the way that this album is as far as the way it addresses women. For as great as this album is, it's sort of relentless. In terms of like the way that it depicts women, it is one of the most misogynistic albums in the history of rock and roll. There's very little doubt in my mind there that it would pretty much have to make the top five on anybody's list of albums about hating women. For this next song, even you know Keith Richards had to eventually respond. I mean, in 1971, he's still talking about it, and he says it was all a spinoff from our environment, hotels and too many dumb chicks. Not all dumb, not by any means, but that's how one got. When you're canned up, half the time it's impossible to go out. It was to go through a whole sort of football match. So they just felt that they were surrounded by a bunch of dumb, crazy, screaming girls.
Oh, boy.
And so they basically, it gave them a thought, and they ended up writing something that sounds almost like a garage rock song. It's not one of the most well-written songs either by the Rolling Stones, but it survives almost perfectly on its snotty attitude. It's called Look at That Stupid Girl. Jagger's own take on that same song. His quote is, "Yeah, it's much nastier than under my thumb, obviously." I was having a bit of trouble. I wasn't in a good relationship, or I was in too many bad relationships. I had so many girlfriends at that point. None of them seemed to care that they weren't pleasing me very much. I was obviously in with the wrong group.
Oops.
Rather funny, but it sets a tone coming so early.
I guess so.
On the album, you know? Another thing that sets the tone on this, and it's not talked about often enough, I don't think, but the entire album was recorded here in the United States. None of it recorded in England, as you would have imagined. In fact, all of it was recorded in Los Angeles at RCA Studios in Hollywood. And Andrew Lou Goldham, the band's manager, always gets credit for producer. But really, what was happening is the Stones were doing most of the production themselves, and they were relying heavily on the engineers who were helping them. And there was an engineer named Dave Hassinger, who was working in RCA Studios at that time. And you never hear his name, Dave Hassinger, at all, ever brought up. But it's quite obvious that he must have had an awful lot to do with this album developing the way that it did. Because you hear the Stones reaching for different instruments, going for different sounds. Like, listen, look at what happened on Painted Black, the way that that was produced and the different instruments that are being used. The next track, Lady Jane. There's all sorts of different things that the band is going for. And, you know, Brian Jones reaching for things like dulcimer and sitar. You know, it's just rather interesting.
How did you arrive at this guy's name then?
I mean, it's on the record.
Oh.
It just says, you know, his name is on the album. But you just don't hear people giving him much credit. And it seems to me, from an outsider's viewpoint, that this album is such an obvious sign of growth for the band that it's probably the first time that the band had some room to work, the time to work on it, and a friendly engineer who was had no desire to rush them.
No pressure.
Right, to let them work at their own pace and to let them feel free to do what they wanted to do. So, if you know, without anybody else really being a producer except for their manager, it kind of falls to the engineer at that point in time to establish a mood in the studio. It's just the way that it is. The person behind the board is really very responsible for what happens in a recording studio, especially if there's no one person in charge coming up with arrangements and doing it all for the band. So I give this guy, Dave Hassinger, a lot of credit. And Yet another song that could be seen as misogynistic in a way, Lady Jane. It's a beautiful song. Very unlike what people were expecting from the Rolling Stones, but lyrically it kind of does fit. It sounds like, what is it? Is it a guy basically trying to choose his place among three different women who he is courting? Is it something a little bit more, you know, more sexual than that? Is it a drug reference? Is it all of the above? Are they being coy? As you know, I'm sure that Jagger was being coy. I'm sure that most of the things that we assign to this song as being, a potential interpretation makes some sense. You know, Jagger knew a Lady Jane Ormsby Gore. I remember that in particular. Was he more or less trying to, in a sense, court her favor because he knew that she was obviously from royalty? And the Stones, if nothing else, didn't like hanging around with the stupid girls, as you could hear from the previous song. So all of this comes into play. And not only that, but the song also has a way of sounding as if it's about royalty, the way that it's played, the instruments that they use. So again, a lot of it has to do with the production to set the mood for what they're trying to say, again, about women in general. This is called Lady Jane.
My sweet Lady Jane, when I see you again, your servant am I, and will humbly remain. Just heed this plea, my love, on bended knees, my love, I pledge myself to Lady Jane. My dear Lady Anne, I've done what I can. I must take my leave, for promised I am. Run, my love, your time has come, my love, I pledge my troth to Lady Jane.
Brian Jones playing the dulcimer on that track. You got to notice on almost every track, this is the album where, I mean, Brian sort of lost control of the band's material on this album. He was the blues man. He was the man that brought the band together based around blues. And by being the blues guy, it was very he was very important to the band when they were doing all of those cover songs,
right,
because he brought a huge amount of credibility when they would do Chicago blues, or really any type of American blues, but particularly Chicago blues, because that's where the Stones really excelled in their early years, as the previous albums indicate. But at this point in time now, Jagger and Richard write everything. And it's not like you want to put a brake on that, because,
right,
you know, obviously that's a good sign. But Brian Jones wasn't really feeling capable of writing. So he started pushing his creativity in different ways. On almost every track, you'll hear him moving to a different instrument. For example, the next song, not to flog a dead horse, but it's another song that's purely misogynistic. Probably one of the most famously misogynistic songs the Stones had ever written. And in this instance, you hear Brian Jones moving to the marimba. Well, Mick Jagger just moves to a different attitude in a different way to put down his girlfriend by showing that he can pretty much do anything he wants to do, and she's just going to have to take it because she's under my thumb. Regardless of the politics, even if you're a feminist, there has to be, you have to find some humor in the song, and because it's a great song. You know, yes, the words are quite plainly about, I guess, sexual suppression. But I mean, doesn't it even like seem a little bit funny that he refers to her as a pet and then, you know, calls her a Siamese cat, you know, calls her a squirming dog who, you know, a squirming dog. Amazing. He goes everywhere but to the B word, but you know it's there. You just know that that's what's backing it all up. As Jagger said, it was actually a caricature in reply to a girl who was a very pushy woman. But the song was a hit in its own right, and to this day is considered one of the best songs that the Stones had released. And interestingly, that is the song that they were playing when Meredith Hunter was murdered in California, when they were playing at Altamont.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody tends to think that it was Sympathy for the Devil, but that's not the case. It was Under My Thumb. Well, we'll keep moving through it, through side one. Just keep on, you know, ripping through these songs, you know, basically about putting down partners. This is called Don't You Bother Me.
About a year ago, how we lived, I'll never know.
One of the best things about the album Aftermath, I think, is that the deep tracks are great and they're really consistent. And that's like, you realize that, you know, this is the album where you realize that the Stones aren't just a band with a couple of hits and some really great blues covers that they put out as filler, which a lot of maybe some American kids might have seen it that way in the beginning. This album, it's just from beginning to end, it's very original. And of course it is. They've written everything. And the non-single tracks, the LP tracks, go deep. So that was the end of side one. Let's get right to, so let's hear two from side two. And you hear a bit of even a change here. Now the Stones are getting a little bit, rather, they leave the topic. This is the side that is not about misogyny. Everything on side one was. On side two, actually, it goes the opposite, or it goes out in a totally different direction. Things like the first one, Flight 505, rather is a song about traveling, which doesn't end well for the people on Flight 505.
Oopsie.
We'll play that into High and Dry as well, two back to back.
Yeah.
Country song there, one of the earlier country songs released by the Rolling Stones. High and Dry, name of that. I got to play these next remaining songs quickly because there's a lot of time left here and not a time left on the show. First one's a straight up rock and roll number called It's Not Easy. We'll back that up with another track that features Brian Jones once again on the dulcimer, the same instrument that he played on Lady Jane, a song called I Am Waiting.
Waiting for someone to come out of somewhere. hold out. He can't hold out. Oh yeah, oh yeah. You can't hold out. You can't hold out. Oh yeah, oh yeah. Waiting for someone to come out of somewhere. Waiting for someone to come out of somewhere.
See it come along.
It's Not Easy, followed by I Am Waiting, which leaves us with this one song to go. And 10 minutes left in the show, but I've got to get to it immediately because this is a long song. It's over 11 minutes long, this next track. It's a good example of what I'm talking about with the engineer, Dave Hassinger, and how he had a huge effect on what the Stones were doing. It's a 2.5-minute song that they wrote, probably like anything else, but they start to stretch out and jam, and he just let the tape go. And when they were done, they liked the takes. They decided to put it on the album, and at the time, it was the longest rock and roll song really released by anybody. I think it might be a good example of the first real rock and roll jam.
The first bathroom break song.
Right. It's called Going Home, which is exactly what we've got to do as this song plays. Everybody have a great week. We'll be back on Friday. Hope you enjoyed listening to Aftermath with us. Take care.
Spending too much time away. I can't stand another day. Maybe you think I've seen the world, but I'd rather see my girl. I'm going home. I'm going home. I'm going home. I'm going home. Going home, bone, 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 home, bone, 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 back home. Yes, I am. All those letters every day may be all right in their way, but I'd love to see your face when I get home in their place. I'm going home. 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 Bone, 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 home. Bone, 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 back home. Yes, I am. going home. I'm going home. I'm going home. I'm going home. I'm going home. Yes, I will. When you're 3,000 miles away, I just never sleep the same. If I pack my things right now, I could be home in 7 hours. I'm going home. 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 Bom, 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 home. Bom, 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 back home. Yes, I will. Yes, I will. I see my baby. I see my baby. I wanna see my girl. I just can't wait. 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 Yeah, yeah, yeah. I just can't wait. I see my baby. She'll make me feel alright.
Long, long time, long, long time, long, long time. feel all right. I'm gonna see my baby one more time.
But now you're right.